Well, hello and welcome to Connections. I'm Rick Moore, along with Bill Newell, Josh Arnold, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky, and this is our little news magazine that we try to put on here at least two times a week and sometimes three times a week from 10 to 11. Interestingly enough, snow showers this morning have given way to sunshine. So today we have, I think, a very informative lineup once again. We'll be talking with Robin Burns of the Salem Pantry, Lindsay Haight, who is the executive director of the food pantry up in Newburyport, the usual banter with Dave Radigan. I'm really looking forward to that with Bill. And then Josh will be talking with former senatorial candidate Beth Lindstrom about a new business that she is involved in and her opinion on some politics as well. So a very, very full hour coming up here on Connections. Let's say good morning to Bill Newell.
Hey, good morning, Rick. And yeah, and by the way, we will have another Connections program on Friday. We'll post it there. We have a bunch of good guests coming up tomorrow as well. Dan Bauer, the principal at Marblehead High School, and also Leslie Gould from the Beverly Regional Chamber of Commerce, Beverly Area Chamber of Commerce, and Gloucester Public Health Director Karen Carroll. So we've got all that happening. And Josh, welcome to Josh. And what do you want to talk about first up in the news today?
Well, first up, I wanted to just bring into focus an article from the Patch Network, Rachel Nunes, writing yesterday about the stimulus tax return, stimulus money coming back, and letting Massachusetts residents know that the money they're anticipating, that's part of the $2 trillion federal economic relief package, is on its way. A new website has been launched to track the status of your money. If you have not received it yet, U.S. Treasury Staff Secretary Stephen Mnuchin said the Internal Revenue Service created an online portal which launched Wednesday. The portal will help Americans track when their payments are likely to show up in their bank accounts or mailboxes. Through the, quote, Get Americans can not only check on their payment status, but can also confirm payment type, direct deposit or check, and enter bank account information for direct deposit if the Internal Revenue Service doesn't have the information on file.
You know that's obviously the new unemployment numbers came out today nationally. Also, in our program today, we've been doing so much in the last few weeks on the coronavirus, COVID-19, obviously. But our two guests, two of our guests today will be talking about, in particular, some of the real work that they're doing and how the food pantry work, the food distribution work for those in need. I stumbled on another thing today, by the way, not stumbled on it. It jumped right out of the front page of the Daily Item of Lynn, is that churches, the big debate that we're hearing about, oh, should they be in church? Should they not be in church? What about social distancing? Well, I have to be honest with you, of all the heroes that we're seeing in everyday life now look so much more important to us than they did a month and a half ago, church donations are way down, and churches do a lot of the charity work. In other words, a church often will donate to the local charities, and their donations, the church's donations, are down. So the item ran a story about one of the churches that, the pastor was saying, we haven't made a deposit in our bank account since early March. I mean, this is a month and a half later. I mean, and it's another one of the casualties that we're seeing with the coronavirus business takedown, if you will.
And speaking of casualties, guys, I don't know if you saw in the Salem News, probably the Lawrence Eagle Tribune, as well as the Gloucester Times, Newburyport Daily News, a message from publisher Karen Andreas. At least the Gloucester newspaper is going to be cutting back to 4 days a week in print. They won't be printing, I believe it's on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and that's due to the cost of newsprint and the fact that their revenues are also down. Josh, final thought?
No, I just wanted to echo the thoughts on the charity contributing. The churches have it difficult, and all of the other local philanthropic organizations or nonprofit organizations are getting the same trickle-down effect. They can't meet, they can't have fundraising events, and then all of the charities that they give money to are going to be impacted. So you're going to start to see that more and more in the next few months until we get back into the flow of things.
All right, that's Josh Arnold, Bill Newell with us also here in Connections, and let others know about it. You can let us know about it at MU Sports.
MN News Sports is a unique multimedia website providing exclusive news and sports content for the North Shore. Our goal is to keep you connected to your local neighbors throughout Essex County and beyond. We feature the best of the North Shore, and we couldn't provide this service without the powerful support of our local sponsors. Like Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury, the Bradford Tavern in Rowley. Just like us, they care about the North Shore. Check out all of our podcasts and share our website with your friends. Email us at msonewsports@gmail.com. msonewsports@gmail.com. Again, we are your connection to the best of the North Shore. msonewsports.com. Robin Burns, the executive director of the Salem Pantry, is joining us here on Connections. And Robin, welcome. Thanks for taking some time to join us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for reaching out, and we're happy to be able to share what the work we're doing. And appreciate that you're interested.
Robin, I want to talk about your work as it is now, but even before this whole COVID-19 coronavirus piece, tell us what your work looked like with the Salem Pantry, say, 2 months ago.
Yeah, great question. Things have evolved so fast that it takes a minute to remember that wasn't that long ago. So actually, one other piece of information is that I actually came on board 3 weeks ago as the executive director and the first ever full-time executive director of the organization. So we're a really small organization. There's only one other person that works with me full-time, my colleague Samantha. She's the operations manager. And then obviously an amazing group of volunteers and a really active board of directors. So prior to this pandemic, the Salem Pantry had focused on a couple different initiatives. One of them was what we call our mobile markets, or the official name is our Fresh Harvest Mobile Market Pop-Up. And what we have been doing for that program is that we go to two locations, about the equivalent of one location a week, spread out over a month. So we'll go two times to a site called Espacio. It's a space that is run by the North Shore Community Development Corporation, and it's in the Point neighborhood of Salem. We go there two Saturdays a month, and then we also partner with Salem State University to run a mobile pantry there on two Wednesdays a month. So kind of spaced out, it was about the equivalent of one mobile market per week that we would set up. And then in addition to that, we partnered with Salem Public Schools to run what we call our backpack program. And the idea was that this was an opportunity for students whose families were in need of extra food to get them through the weekend would get a discreetly packed bag each Friday that would go home with them over the weekend. And so we partnered with a number of community volunteers, and each person would sponsor a school. And so essentially everyone would meet up, pack a certain number of bags that they would need for their respective school, and then take them off and kind of, again, work with the staff at the school to kind of discreetly get those to the students that were in most need. So prior to again, COVID-19, those were our two core programs. And when I was hired for the role in February, I know that the board of directors of the Salem Pantry have a vision for kind of expanding our services, and we had a lot of tentative plans for what we wanted to focus on once I came on board in late March. And we are trying to kind of plant the seeds for much of that growth. But in the meantime, we've been just trying to support the community as best we could during COVID-19. So we've ramped up services in a slightly different way than we had intended, but we're kind of doing what makes the most sense to us at the time, for the time being, and also for our partners and the feedback that we're getting from them. And I'd be happy to talk more about that in just a minute.
Absolutely. So just so folks know, and we'll put a link up on our website, but the mobile markets, the dates and the locations are on your website. So it's very available, very, very easy to follow, and times and dates are there for some weeks to come. So that's good news there. As far as do the people access your services right at the pantry itself?
Yeah, great question. So not exactly. So what we've been doing is we've been bringing our services out into the community. We have a home base right now. We share space with LifeBridge, a wonderful agency doing work for the homeless population here in Salem and in greater North Shore. And so we have a small office and kind of like a little hub in one of their buildings where we're kind of packing and preparing food. It's not quite set up so well for kind of on-site pantry visitors. However, we do have a small pantry to service the homeless population that are taking part in LifeBridge's daily activities. They have a drop-in center each day for people to spend time during the day. And so we've got items that are available to the community there. But for the most part, what we're doing is we're bringing our services out into the community. So right now, in addition to the mobile markets, we're doing our school grocery assistance program, where we're bringing groceries, packed groceries, in bags and boxes each week to 14 different locations across the city. So we're partnering with all 14 of the public schools' distribution sites. So some of them are actual schools, and some of them are bus stops, so like that were identified as prime locations in the community where there'd be enough people to kind of congregate to that bus stop during the time that the allotted time frame. And and so that's been really how we've ramped up primarily, is now instead of these mobile markets, we're doing these 14 distributions each week. And then one other program that we've added to that that's happening a little bit more out of our home base is that we've been partnering with the city of Salem and some other agencies to identify vulnerable community members who are not able to physically get out to the site. So for us, every Thursday, we are coordinating a delivery effort where we're doing a similar pre-packing model, and then we're loading volunteer vehicles and some of our own vehicles to go out and do kind of a handful of deliveries each. And so last week, we did about 50 deliveries to community members in Salem on the Thursday afternoon on top of kind of our normal distribution.
Robin, I'm listening to you, and I'm just in awe or struck by the volume of what you're doing. The depth and the breadth of it. It's just incredible.
Yeah, we've really ramped up really fast. Just some recent numbers for any of the listeners that would be curious about this. So through the mobile market program, at our two most recent mobile markets that we had numbers for, so that would be one Salem State Market and one of our what we call the Espacio Market, we served 290 guests, so 290 households, so one person representing that household. Almost 100 of those people were first-time visitors to the mobile market, and it was just under 12,000 pounds of groceries that we distributed on that day. And then for the most recent week of grocery assistance through Salem Public Schools, we provided just under 10,000 pounds of fresh produce and groceries to 325 households. And so, yeah, that's all happening kind of, over the span of 1 week, and from an agency that just has two full-time staff. It's really kind of, we're pushing the limits for our capacity, but at the same time, we've been able to tap into this amazing volunteer support in the community, and it's just been so wonderful having all of these people step up trying to support this work and trying to help their community as well.
Again, wow. Let me follow up. So volunteers, are you always looking for volunteers? Are you looking for volunteers now?
Yes, we are. Yeah, any interested volunteer, they could, as you mentioned earlier on our website, we actually have a special kind of COVID-19 update page, so people can kind of click on that page from the home site, and we've got information about volunteering, donating, where the markets are, where the school setups are going to be, and then other update information, including a public health update, where we're kind of making sure that everyone knows that we're in line with all current CDC and City of Salem public health recommendations. In terms of volunteers, we've worked with volunteers for the entirety of the organization. It kind of started out as a volunteer-run organization. And we've seen kind of an uptick of volunteers that are new volunteers to us since the pandemic has has hit. A lot of folks that are either working remotely, some people that have been furloughed or laid off, some people that, you know, perhaps whatever their situation is, they're just kind of freed up. Some people are just looking forward to giving back. Some people are looking forward to get out in the house, frankly, and some people like to just come in, sign up for an hour or two and kind of help box groceries. Some people have preferred to be more on the front end of things, out in the community distributing. Some people have preferred to be on the back end, kind of just kind of helping behind the scenes. We've even had volunteer drivers that have been assisting with us going into Boston to pick up thousands of pounds at the Greater Boston Food Bank in a box truck. So we're really kind of running the gamut of what's possible. And it's been really made possible through this kind of volunteer support. And, you know, as we continue doing this work and as the COVID-19 reality seems to not really have an end date, we haven't been able to see the light at the end of the tunnel yet. We're continually trying to reach out to get more people to volunteer just so we don't burn out the current pool of folks. And we want to be mindful of everyone's capacity and, you know, thankful for everything that they give, but really don't want to overdo it with anyone in particular. So anyone that's interested, please reach out to us, and we'd love to find a place where you could fit in.
I also, well, I'm on your website as we're talking, which is thesalempantry.org, salempantry.org, and if you click on the donate tab, go through it either way, you can take credit cards, but also if folks feel more comfortable, sometimes folks do feel more comfortable. I'm an old guy. I'd rather send a check, I guess, maybe, you know, but, you know, and but you have your address there with the P.O. box and everything. So, man, that is the way to go. And I think in these times, as I've heard from others, that cash is a huge help at this time because of all the added expenses you're incurring as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, normally, you know, classic food pantry donation could range from everything from a financial donation to volunteering to actually canned goods or canned drive. At the time being, we're not accepting any kind of individual donations of items like that that we might kind of normally be taking. So, yeah, we are, you know, for anyone that's able to, you know, a cash donation is really, really supportive of this work right now to help us keep up with kind of all of the behind-the-scenes costs to make this run. And then, obviously, I've been talking a lot about the volunteer support. So that's two great ways that people could contribute.
Unbelievable. Hey, Robin, tell me, you mentioned you're new, you know, within 3 weeks to the Salem Pantry. So what's what brought you to the Salem Food Pantry? Where have you been before?
Yeah, so I'm a Salem resident. I, for the past 5 years, have been working in Cambridge and Boston for an organization that was running a school garden program in partnership with Cambridge and Boston Public Schools. I was looking for something closer to home. Hmm. Prior to that, I lived in and worked in Lynn for an organization called the Food Project and was doing community food systems work, so running farmers markets and working with high school students and growing food in the city. So I've kind of been around gardens, food, food distribution for off and on for almost 20 years now. And so when thinking about something closer to home, something in Salem, this opportunity kind of popped up for me kind of earlier in the year and just seemed like a great fit. I obviously did not realize I would be starting during the middle of the crisis. However, you know, I feel like I'm up for the challenge and I'm really energized each day by this community work that I'm kind of nestled into. And I just feel, it just feels really powerful to be able to do this. And I know that I'm not alone stepping in as this first time full-time executive director for this kind of small nonprofit. And it just feels really great to be able to kind of walk to work, engage in this, try to support my community, and then to kind of go home and kind of be reflecting about that impact and kind of hopefully coming at it the next day with, you know, just that same energy I had previously.
Yeah. Well, Robin, I think that one of the things with all of this is, you know, our website, we've reached out to a lot of different organizations and they're very inspiring stories of, work that people are doing. They can't top you, though. You're right there with them, Robin. Man, congratulations to you, Samantha, in your office as well. Of course, all of your volunteers. And hopefully some of our listeners might be able to click on that donate button and help you guys out because, man, you're doing a lot of work, very much needed work. And And thanks so much for your time and joining us to share your story and the story of the Salem Food Pantry.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Bill. And thanks to your listeners for listening to our story here in Salem. And I hope that I can talk to you soon, hopefully under like lighter circumstances.
Absolutely. That's Robin Burns, the executive director of the Salem Pantry. Again, that's thesalempantry.org. And you're listening to Connections.
This is Connections on MSONewsSports.com.
All right, we're joined now by Lindsay Haight, who is the executive director of Our Neighbor's Table in Newburyport. And Lindsay, welcome to MSO.
Thanks so much, Rick, for having me.
This is my first foray up there to Newburyport in terms of this kind of thing. Can, first of all, tell us a little bit about your background in terms of Our Neighbor's Table, maybe where it's located, and some of the services that you provide.
Sure. So Our Neighbor's Table has been around since 1992, and our focus is on providing food and a sense of community for people who live in the northeastern corner of Massachusetts, the greater Amesbury and Newburyport area. We serve 12 cities and towns from Boxford and Rowley north. And in that area, there are about 6,500 people living in food insecure households. And last year, in 2019, we had served approximately 4,800 of them.
Wow.
And so our primary service is to provide free groceries. We have two community-based markets. They very much resemble a grocery store. People come in, shop for whatever they need, just like they would be going to, you know, your local grocer. The only difference is they get all of that food at no cost to them, thanks to the generosity of the community and some of our food supply partners. And then we have a community meal every week as well.
And where are you located, Lindsay?
Our home base is in Amesbury. Uh-huh. Our two community-based markets are in Amesbury and Newburyport. Our weekly dinner is in Amesbury. And then we do have some other pop-up markets that we operate in Merrimack and Amesbury as well.
That's incredible. And what are you doing at this point right now? In other words, what's changed? How are you dealing with those in need?
Yeah, you know, since we opened in 2016, the grocery markets that I just, they've really been a source of pride and, for the communities. And we, unfortunately, because of the public health directions, have had to close those markets to the public and switch all of our operations to curbside market or curbside grocery pickup. So now guests order from us online the day before and schedule an appointment to pick up, and they come much like a drive-through, and they never get out of their car. They pop their trunk, and we put the food inside. So, you know, it's still seamless for the guests, at least those who can access the internet. For those who can't, we do phone orders. You know, internally, our operations have just completely changed. Now we're more of a warehouse distribution center, and our staff are on the phones constantly all day long. So it's a very different feel for us internally, and it's a very different feel for our guests, too, who are used to coming into, you know, their neighborhood markets and getting to see their neighbors, and now, you know, we at least get to wave through the car windows.
That's an amazing transition, really, to go from a supermarket to a takeout window. And I imagine you did it in a relatively short time. How did you manage the transition? And you know, how did your staff deal with that? Who did you have on board and so on?
Yeah. So we already operate from with a very small staff. We only have a staff of 11. And a couple of our staff themselves have, you know, their own risks or concerns for their families. And so some of them have already had to work remotely. So we've cut that down. We also rely very heavily, because we have such a small staff, most of our programs are still delivered by volunteers. But because of social distancing and the size of our space, we had to cut our volunteer core by about 80 to 85%. And so we're doing all of it on about 20% of the workforce that we normally operate on. So I guess the short answer would be a lot of sleepless nights.
Long days,
just to turn everything around.
It's funny. I was going to say, I bet you sleep well at night because you're so tired. But you're right. I imagine so many things are going through your head in this transition and making sure you check off all the boxes to make sure everything's going correctly. How has the transition been? Because it sounds like at this point it's running along pretty well.
It is. You know, I think last week we finally started to turn the corner. And so, you know, the calls coming into our office are fewer now. People, you know, are getting to understand our new operations and how to use our website. So I think our shoppers are getting used to that, and we're putting the systems in place and being able to engage some of our volunteers remotely to take on some of these tasks behind the scenes. So I think we're finally turning the corner. We're understanding our new normal. But, you know, I was just training a volunteer this morning, and we were talking about how to register a new guest. And that normally in an in-person environment is maybe a two-step process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because we don't get to see each other and we have people working at different sites, it's a 14.
God. Oh, my.
And that's what we're going to have to sustain for the next however many months that this goes on.
Have you seen an increase in people who are asking for help?
Tremendously. We've been, you know, just kind of watching our numbers and just since the month before all of this broke. So comparing, you know, from March 16th to now to the previous month, before March 16th, we've had a 17% increase in the pounds of food that we're distributing. We have increased the volume of new registrations by 5. You know, we used to register maybe in the course of a month, we'd register maybe 30 new households that had never come to our programs before. And we've registered almost 170 in the last 4 weeks. So again, that 14-step process that I just described, we have to process 170 people through that. We're just not quite equipped to do that. But the good news is that our food supply has been strong. And so, you know, once we can get the operations out and get people through the process, they can get the groceries that they need. So we've enrolled, I think it was just over 400 new people, so 170 households, but they're made up of about 400 people who had never been getting programs from services from us before. But they are all now getting a really beautiful bag of groceries with meat and fresh fruits and vegetables and milk and eggs, as well as all the other, you know, canned and box staples that we have in our kitchen.
Well, I'm going to make a political statement here. I don't know about Make America Great Again, but what you do and what your people do is part of what has always made America great. So thank you so much for that. And I want to ask you, Lindsay, in terms of this thing has gone on now, and you know, you've had your steady supply, you've had your experience so over the course of years, but this thing broke. There's an adrenaline rush. People rush to help. The businesses have rushed to help. Is that being sustained, or now that you know we're 30 days or plus 30 days plus into this thing, is it beginning to dwindle a little bit in terms of your getting what you need in terms of either volunteer help or monetary help?
You know, I have to say, I really want to give a huge shout out and thanks to everyone in the greater Amesbury and Newburyport region, because people do continue to keep food access at the top of their minds and thinking about more and more people who are getting laid off from work or, you know, are depleting their savings. So, you know, I think that the outreach I feel is still strong. And, you know, in our area, you know, we're we're kind of behind the curve in terms of infection. So we're only just starting to see rates of infection in our region climb. So I'm not sure how that's going to affect people's ability to help as we become more impacted directly by the virus. But people have, you know, the outpouring of generosity has been truly amazing. And, you know, if a lot of people have joined our Breakfast Club, which is our club of sustaining donors, people who make a monetary donation every month. It's just automated through their bank account or credit card. And that's really heartening because, you know, they give a little bit less at a time, but we know that they're with us for the long haul. So that's really meaningful.
Well, I was going to ask you what your biggest need is. So how do people do that? I'm guessing that the food drop-off is a no-no right now, and the best way to do it is through gift cards or with money.
Yeah, I think financial donations are really are most helpful for us and you know, for our peer organizations as well. We can't have the public just coming to our site, dropping off donations. We don't want extra people handling product in uncontrolled environments. And so financial contributions, they can make them right on our website, ourneighborstable.org/give. You know, whether you're giving to us or any of our peer organizations in the community, they, you know, that's really the best way for us to help. It gives us the flexibility, whether we have to pay overtime for our staff, buying lunches for our volunteers who are now working 8 to 10 hour shifts, or purchasing food to supplement our food supply chain right now, or just putting gas in our trucks to be able to keep them on the road to pick up food that is available to us.
And if there is someone in need, I know that you deal confidentially and compassionately with people. How is the best way for them to get a hold of you guys?
Yeah, whether you can give or you need to receive at this time, ourneighborstable.org is really your one-stop shop. There's we have an ourneighborstable.org/getfood. That get food link is right on our homepage as well. We are seeing so many people who, you know, maybe have been giving to us all these years and have now both earners in the household have lost their jobs. And, you know, the stories that they're sharing are just so compelling. And I guess I just want to say it's never been more discreet than it is now. You register online, you come through in your car, you never even get out, so you're really only making eye contact with one volunteer on the curbside, maybe two. So I know in normal circumstances, people's pride and fear keep them from accessing help all the time. And now where it's affecting so many people, you can do this. You know, this is the one thing you can control, being able to put food on the table for your kids when everything else is going, you know, seems to be crumbling around you. This is one thing you can control, and you can do it discreetly. It's practically anonymous. Everything at Our Neighbor's Table is 100% confidential. So I just encourage you to go to ourneighborstable.org/getfood, register, place your orders, and get the food you need.
Oh, very, very powerful. Lindsay, is there anything else you'd like to mention about staff or about production or about needs maybe that I haven't asked you about?
You know, I think, again, I just want to give kudos to all of our staff and volunteers who are here, even those who can't be with us physically are constantly reaching out. And I just want to say thank you to everybody. They're really incredible. And I think it's really heartwarming to know that food security is on the top of everyone's mind during this public health crisis. I think it's a huge testament to the increase in awareness of the issue in our region. And, you know, it gives me hope for what we can sustain after this crisis is over.
That is Lindsay Haight, who is the executive director of Our Neighbor's Table. With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore.
I'm Bob Gillis, president of KPN Savings Bank, serving the KPN community with stability and commitment for over 170 years. Since 1846, our customers have relied on our local bank service and big bank benefits. Stop by our offices or call to talk about your banking needs at 978-283-0246. Built on community. CapeAndSavings.Bank.
Member FDIC. Member DIF. Equal housing lender.
Gloucester's Walter Wilkins Insurance Agency is teaming up with Columbia Insurance to deliver a full line of products, personal home and auto policies, as well as a full line of commercial coverage for business owners, including commercial property and commercial vehicle coverage. Wilkins partners with respected companies such as Plymouth Rock, Quincy Mutual, Commerce, and Safeco. For City of Gloucester employees, there are discounts on auto and home policies. Wilkins Insurance is located at 186 Main Street, Gloucester, now partnering with Columbia Insurance, serving the North Shore.
Connections continues. I'm Bill Newell with Dave Radigan, educator, comedian, and Dave, welcome. Good to be talking with you again.
Nice to be here, Bill. Good to talk to you.
Dave and I are doing this on Zoom so we can see each other, even though we are legally socially distancing ourselves from one another.
Yes, and they won't be able to see this. You're saying to me, you won't be podcasting this as something anyone can see. So you're telling me I showered for nothing.
You're right. You look marvelous, but no one will know that other than if I were to tell the folks that you look marvelous. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the big winners in this whole coronavirus thing. And I read a story yesterday about the winners and losers from the coronavirus, and they meant the stocks, but obviously Zoom is one of the big winners because you said Zoom to most people, before this started, and they would have said, "Oh, the old PBS series for kids," and now it's a good stock to buy, or let's put it this way: a lot of people are buying. It's a hot stock to buy, and everybody knows Zoom now.
Yeah, everyone knows Zoom. Saturday Night Live did an all virtual show this past week after being off for a number of weeks, and they did a bit on Zoom because as people get familiar with Zoom and start using it, there are a lot of people, like you just mentioned, Dave, never used it before. So there's Zoom etiquette out there that people need to know, and some people don't follow. In fact, even you told me, Bill, sit a little higher, get a little higher in the screen, right?
Yeah. You want to have your head a little higher. You don't want to have a ton of headroom. It's sort of like with television. You want to have approximate what they would do on television, and you don't want giant amounts of headroom. You don't want light. You want light on your face, but you don't want light behind you, like from windows. And there's a thing when you actually talk. I mean, what they say is when you present, you talk to people, you're supposed to look at the little camera that's at the top of your screen in your computer. But of course, if you do that, not looking at the people you're talking to, but you realize like a disconnect there. As you're being connected, you're also disconnecting. And it's an interesting way to communicate. I'm actually glad I'm doing it. It's a really interesting experience. Even though the last two classes I've had in the middle of my class, Bill, I've been cut off. I've been disconnected in the middle of my class. And then I have to go and I have to reconnect and get back into the class. And I find the class is still going. And and in my head, I'm thinking, did I do that? Did Zoom do that? Or did one of my students just get sick of me and think, I'll just get rid of them for a while?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you can do that, but yeah, that would make sense. But again, the Saturday Night Live bit, I mean, people, you know, take their laptops. One of the pieces was, you know, into the bathroom, and, you know, you can't do that. People forget that you can see them on Zoom. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, my students, I'll see my students do it, and all of a sudden they'll turn so we can all see their dog. And they'll be in the middle of a class and they'll be on Zoom and their mothers will walk in and start talking to them. And it's really funny. And they also, a lot of students will turn themselves off. They turn off their video and they turn themselves to mute. And I treat them like adults. I figure if they're there, they're there. But for all I know, they're in the next room playing Parcheesi or,
yeah, that's Parcheesi is probably what they're doing, Dave. Yeah, these are college students, Dave. Right, right. Okay. Oh man, this guy is clueless, folks. Okay, now move on here. So there's a couple known in our kind of a different meaning now to us, and you all know what they are. So, hand sanitizer, toilet paper, long grocery lists, isolation. Now we're afraid to go into grocery stores. Our wardrobe, you know, has been limited to sweats for the last month here. And here's another one, Dave. We are now heroes for getting takeout food. I love that. We're now heroes. I used to think I was lazy. We were beat. We were tired. We go out and get takeout food. Now we're heroes.
Yes, you are. You're supporting the local economy and local local business. You're a hero. You're a hero. We can all pat ourselves on the back as we eat our poo-poo platters.
Yeah, that Bill Newell got Chinese food. God bless him. God bless him.
Well, you know, the flip side of it is when this started, there were people who were avoiding Chinese restaurants for the same reason. I mean, in late February, early March, I would say, you know, I'm a comedian. I work in Chinese restaurants. And I was told by a couple of people, it's like, yeah, our business has been slow ever since it started because they're afraid. And you're right. I mean, face masks. You're an old guy. I say face mask. You think Jock Plant. But it's not about that. It's about face masks that people wear for personal protective equipment, which, and again, I you know, for weeks I hear, don't get face masks, don't hoard face masks. They don't do you any good. They don't do any good, but the people in the hospitals need them, which I always thought was kind of funny because I went to emergency with my daughter and there were some people, some of the nurses that had face masks on. And I thought, huh, I wonder why they're wearing it since they've told us that it doesn't do any good. But then all of a sudden we wake up one day and they're like, get a face mask. Don't go out without a face mask. And I didn't have one. Luckily I found one bandana, but I'm going with one bandana over and over. And I'm thinking, how am I going to keep that bandana clean?
Yeah. You know, it used to be if you walked into a store on a face mask, you might get arrested or, you know, they call security on you or something like that. Now,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah.
I look exactly what they say not to dress like when you go to the back.
I mean, okay, well, the guy had a face mask on. He looked like a slob.
I was out walking in Beverly the other day. And it was a woman, and she had a hat on. Probably I'm just going to guess that she probably got up. She probably didn't shower. She's got these baggy black pants on, a black jacket, a black hat, a face mask, and glasses.
And a cheery disposition.
Yeah, exactly. And no, she seemed pleasant enough. But but all I could think of is if I was going to go to dress, if I was going to rob a bank, if I was going to knock over a liquor store, that's what I'd wear. If I was going to be in a gang, that's what I'd start. A robbing gang.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Hey, I got two last things here for you. We're watching press conferences. I think everyone, whether you love Trump or hate Trump, can agree that he talks too much. Yeah, those are my – and here's one last one here. We listen to all these press conferences. We listen about the data, the communities and different things. They talk about hot areas in the country, and that's all new to me because I used to think those were strip clubs on Route 1 in Peabody.
Yeah, I think the hot areas have taken on a whole new meaning. Now it's like walking – well, it was walking trails before, but now they've closed many of those. So now it's places like the Dane Street Beach in Beverly, you know, along Lothrop Street, it's made national news because you can walk on one side of the street or the other. And I guess you're supposed to walk basically against the traffic because there were so many people going out to the beach, and they've closed a lot of these outdoor areas. And of course that means that more people go to smaller, you know, there's more congestion in the places that are open, which are the public parks and beaches.
You know, they close the parking lots for the public parks and beaches, but they leave the Market Basket parking lot open, which is the most dangerous spot in the whole world, is walking through the Market Basket parking lot.
Right, just from all the dropped gloves, from all the dropped protective gloves and protective masks.
Man slips on glove in Market Basket parking lot and is run over twice. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I know. Dave, always good talking with you. I want you to be safe, and I want you to grab some hand sanitizer here before the next time we talk, all right?
I'll do that.
Dave Radigan with us here. I'm Bill Newell on Connections. We'll continue just ahead after these messages.
All right. Actually, don't have any messages at this time, Bill, but rather we're going to turn it right over to Josh Arnold here on Connections, and Josh has next guest. Josh?
Welcome back to Connections, and our next guest is Beth Lindstrom. Beth?
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Well, you know, you and I talked before the show, and I know that we're going to talk about some of the local and national politics, but I also know that you're involved in a business endeavor that's sort of new. Can you share that with us, what that's all about?
Sure, great. Thanks so much. Yeah, I'm an advisor for a company called Gentrio, and it's a Massachusetts-based online estate planning company. And actually, right now, it's pretty relevant because so many people in this pandemic are giving second thoughts to do they have their documents in place. So Gentrio actually, you know, you can go online, you can make your will, power of attorney, healthcare proxy, and believe it or not, pet care, power of attorney, which is really important. And right now we actually have an essentials employee initiative where we're waiving 80% off of the cost of it, which is affordable regardless. It's all your information stored up in the cloud. So for folks who are listening, if they are on the front lines, you know, we appreciate everything you do. And but go check out Gentrio and take advantage of the opportunity to get your affairs, not affairs in order, but your documents in place.
Great, great. Now, in terms of politics, the political landscape is ever-changing, and it's changed in particular with the coronavirus. Can you share some observations of what you've seen, both at the state and national level?
Well, sure. I think it impacts everybody. I mean, this is such a huge issue for people who are running for office. I mean, you look at, you know, Biden in the basement, quote unquote, you know, all politics is local, and that really prevents candidates from going out and meeting and greeting. I mean, whether that's, you know, down to the local state rep or, you know, up to running for president. It's interesting because I think when Sanders got out of the race, I mean, you know, the political news was crazy for so long about Biden and Sanders. And then all of a sudden when Sanders gets out, it was like a non-moment on the news. It was really, I thought, pretty shocking to me. But I also think that the challenge is fundraising. You know, people aren't working. As you know, so many people are on unemployment. So it's definitely impacting all our races across the board.
How likely are people to give money to a campaign that aren't working? That's, you know, very...
Right, and I think that's the challenge. Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the comparisons, there are different things that had a certain life cycle that made sense given the logic of the moment, and now, in hindsight, because of the virus, put people in a bit of a frenzy. So Biden had about $20 million on hand in cash after expenses, middle, end of March, going into April. Trump had $225 million. There's an advantage there. But Trump, on the other hand, is has the what's happening with the virus. I mean, if you looked at him 2 months ago, his biggest accomplishment was what he did to the economy, and that's been wiped out.
Yeah, but I would argue, though, Josh, that if we hadn't been in such a good position in the economy, where would we be today? Much worse off, I believe. And I think, you know, people have, because they've had increased money in their pockets, a little wherewithal, maybe some of this storm. But, you know, and I'm a small business owner also. I've got 11 employees in a small business, and, you know, they are employees. They are collecting unemployment. They're getting those extra stimulus checks or rescue checks, as I would call right now. Yeah. And we've applied for a loan, and we're going to get some of that money and put them back on payroll. But, you know, we're probably not typical of most small businesses. I mean, there are going to be a lot that are hurt. And so, again, how does that contribute to the political campaigning?
Josh, can I interject here for one question?
Sure.
Okay, and I know you want to get back to that. And Beth, first of all, I remember when we first talked with you, you mentioned, we wanted a senator in this state who was working for Massachusetts and not running for president. And that still resonates with me because she declared so early. But in terms of the way the governor or governors, period, have handled this situation, what are your observations with respect to the federal government's involvement and then the local government, particularly Governor Baker?
Well, you know, that is really interesting. Having sat on Governor Romney's cabinet and preparing for the bird flu at one point, you know that there are initiatives that you have to do at a state level. There are the partnerships that you have at the federal level, and then you have at the local level. And I think for someone like Charlie Baker, who has been a selectman before, understands kind of all, you know, certainly those two levels and how they interplay with each other. And you know, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal today, I think, about, you know, does Trump have the absolute right? And it was a good article that talked about, you know, the president has rights when the states and the feds are doing the same things. Does the Fed supersede? It does in some areas. That's how it is in some regulation. So, you know, because sometimes you have a state regulation, Fed regulations, you know, who supersedes? So, but I think the bottom line and what people want to see is our government working for them and working together. And so I think it's great that the president is out front there with his briefings. I mean, you know, it's always colorful, but nonetheless, he's out there talking about and trying to give hope. You don't want a president who's not giving hope, right? But you have to be realistic and you have to listen to those scientists. Then, you know, coming down to the state level, it's smart for our governors to coalesce together and to say, okay, you know, we are a region. How do we deal with this? Because people don't just sit home. They travel. Where do they go? Just like anything in commerce. So I think for the average consumer, the person who's sitting home in there right now saying, when can we get out? They look to these leaders, and that's what it is. It is about leadership, and some will succeed, governors, in reopening their states, and some will fail, and the proof will be in the pudding when we see how that rolls out.
Josh?
What are the things that you and I talked about, Beth, and I've said this in as an advisor in political campaigns. I talked about the strength of one's support, and I always use the Hellman's mayonnaise example, and that was, I happen to like Hellman's mayonnaise. If I went to the store and they didn't have it, I wouldn't buy Cane's or substitute. I'd go to the store that had Hellman's and get it. That's the highest form of product brand preference that there is. Ideally, that's what you want to have as a candidate, be it for election or re-election. You want to have a solid backing. And you made the observation about the ups and downs of candidates, presidents in the several elections, given the ups and downs of the economy, the wars, and so forth. But that Donald Trump tracked a little bit different. Can you share with us that was about?
Yeah. I think there was a couple months ago, Pew Research came out and they had, they tracked past presidents, Republicans and Democrats, probably for the last 20 years, and they showed their favorability rating, and they are always tied to external events. And so it was interesting when you looked at all these presidents and, you know, through their chronological timeline, you had, you know, kind of the up and down, the bellwether up and down. And then Trump's was steady across all the years he's been president. And I think that that's a very telling, because that shows that his base is so solid of people who are just have the same belief system or who he's speaking to with his, whether it's Make America Great Again or whatever his narrative is. And you didn't see that with any other president in history. So I think that really tells us that he does have a strong base through thick or thin. And we know that government right now is so polarizing. So the person sitting at home is, you know, whether it's cat or whether it's, you know, impeachment, it's they're getting a sense of, okay, can we just let our president be president and, you know, finally get through all of that. Now it's this pandemic. And then, of course, the rescue bill or the first stimulus. But it's, I think that people are becoming more astute to what's happening. And what I'm trying to get to is that he has a solid base. I think that's only going to go up or, you know, stay the same even through this pandemic. Because everyone always says, you know, what's going to happen in the 2020 election? And I think there's a lot of people out there who probably support the president, maybe doesn't support his behaviors and so forth, but they don't. And when the polling doesn't really show, so I think there's about a 5% bump in polling that you'd see also if you ask those questions about reelecting the president.
Well, I think the polling thing is off anyway for a couple of reasons. One is, I asked the question. Are these the same polls that said Hillary's going to win by 10 or 12 points as much as a month or 3 weeks before the election? Part of the problem I saw from the polling in 2016 was that I didn't see, you didn't get into the, they didn't show you what the mechanics of the validity test were, but I questioned how valid they were. I mean, when I've done polling in the past, and we'd come up with a validity question like, did you vote in the past state election or municipal election? And if they said yes, you went back and checked, and if they didn't, you had to exclude that. And I'm not sure how valid some of the mechanics are on the one hand.
Right.
On the other side of it, I think a lot of people were intimidated by being supporters of Trump. They didn't want to be, you know, somehow someone was going to record that, and that was, so they kept it. They didn't say who they were going to vote for, or they lied. And I don't
right.
think, I think there's a bump that comes off of every poll that says, okay, yeah, this is what they said they were going to do. What are they, you know, what's the piece that we don't know? And it stretches beyond the margin of error. Because it's
yeah,
not
I agree.
An error. It's a deliberate error. And that
right.
you can't calculate. What happens with the vice presidential selection? What does Biden have to do now? I'd ask the question, if you were to pick the ideal person, if the ideal person was the person most qualified to step in as president, if something happened to Joe Biden, you might have won selection.
Sure. I mean, I think, first of all, the vice president has already said he's going to pick a woman for vice president. So assuming that that's going to be a female, who could that possibly be? And, you know, the names have been, you know, bantered around. But I think if he does land on Amy Klobuchar, I think she would be the best suited to go and to step in, because she has had a lot of experience. She's worked with a lot of Republicans in the Senate. She's worked with Biden before. I think she seems more authentic than a Kamala Harris. I think Kamala would be, you know, she would be asked to be vice president and could certainly step in. But when you ask the question, who is the most ready, I think Amy Klobuchar would be that person I would suggest if you're asking for a strict answer.
No, that's fine. If you look at some of the people that they've taken in the past, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush took Dan Quayle. And I've said, you know, sometimes it looked like presidents bought a life insurance policy because no one was going to take the president out because of who would succeed them. And whether you liked George H.W. or George W., they were much better than their vice presidents for different reasons. That's why I wondered if, Nixon took Spiro Agnew because he was an attack dog for him. And I wondered if Biden might go take Liz Warren or Kamala Harris to be the attack dog. But I also know that you need some regional balance in there, and that wouldn't work for Biden. I mean, Biden, as Delaware, doesn't have it's what, two or three electoral votes? It's not, you know,
right,
it
but
would
he's
be
already
two...
got the name. He's already been vice president, so I think, you know, that's kind of a, you know, you do that to garner votes. So I don't.
They're going
to
take New York and they're going to take California
right.
anyway, so it doesn't
right.
really have to take one of those people, but he needs to get somebody who's going to, he's be able to work with, and yet not upstage him either. Cuomo's name keeps getting floated out there, even though he says no. But I thought it was interesting that they ran the Bernie endorsement announcement at the same time as the Cuomo conference. I don't know
yes.
if anybody else picked up on that, but I did.
Sure. You know what and if we have a couple of minutes, I'd like to actually go back to talking about signatures locally, too, if we get a moment. But
sure.
But I think... Or Cuomo, I mean, not for nothing, but you don't know. You and I have been in this business long enough that you never know what's going to happen in politics. And if something happens to Biden for some reason, you know, the Democrats may say, okay, you know, is his number two going to be the most enthusiastic and bring excitement to this race? If they're not feeling that, you know, you never know whether they might, I don't know if they can in their party rules, but, you know, after this pandemic is over, you don't know whether they'll draft Cuomo to take the number one. So we never know what's going to happen, and really they can bend rules because we've seen it in the past, you know, with delegate selection and so forth to fit the purpose. But I agree with you. I think I don't know what's going to happen, especially with Elizabeth Warren. I mean, you saw that she did the final endorsement. I think her timing certainly was too late in the game. But on the other hand, does she bring those progressives to the party? And there's even debate about that after what she did to Sanders with the, you know, statement about you said a woman could never win the presidency. And that really divided the two progressive camps. So you wonder whether even if he does go after Warren as a pit bull and someone who is very smart, you know, on policy, he's just not likable at all. So yeah. You know, there's weighing all those factors about each person. And, you know, would she be that right person to bring that policy part of it? But I kind of doubt it, truly. I think they would be thinking about somebody else who's more likable but is going to bring more to the table in the flyover states, or someone who's just going to bring a demographic to the table.
You mentioned signatures, and I meant to bring that up earlier. I know that I've seen the article about Joe Kennedy, who's running on the Democratic side for Senate to go from Congressman to Senate, against Ed Markey, the incumbent. And Markey's got a problem because he doesn't have enough signatures, and the pandemic has impacted that. But it also filters down to people, other people running for state and federal office, too. Do you have any sense of how that's going to play out? Are they going to relax the standards, or is the state legislature the one that has to make that decision, and are they going to kind of take care of their own by discouraging competition, or I don't know?
Event happening today, but the legislature, you know, waited so long to even think about putting forth a bill to lower the signature, some thwarting of that. But in the meantime, there's three people: Kevin O'Connor, who's running for U.S. Senate; Robert Goldstein's running for Congress; and Melissa Bauer Smith, who's a state rep candidate, who's, you know, got autoimmune issues. And Goldstein's an infectious doctor, and they all coalesced to actually bring an emergency petition for relief to the Supreme Judicial Court. And that's being the arguments are being heard today at 2 p.m. Actually, you can go to suffolk.edu or something and watch it. But I think that's going to be very telling because Maura Healey has already agreed, I believe, I don't know if I'm telling tales out of school, but that because she would have to defend the legislature, or Galvin, who's listed in this suit. And I think she already has said that she believes it is unconstitutional. So what I think is going to happen...
She thinks it's unconstitutional?
Yeah, trying to get signatures out, to collect signatures right now in this pandemic. When you look at the social distancing orders and the shutdown orders, you put that all together, and it is really creating hardship. But I think, to your point, it didn't go through the legislature because they, as always, you know, believe that, geez, people are sitting at home and they're unemployed. We don't want anybody to run against us.
Yeah.
And so I really think that's the reason why they waited so long, and then now, you know, I'm not quite sure they're even going to get to a vote. But if they but because of this suit that's happening today, the hearing, that maybe they'll coalesce and make a decision so they don't look like they've, usurped their responsibility, but nonetheless. So we'll see what's happening. So that is actually going to happen 2 p.m. today, those hearings, and get a judgment from the court.
Great. Well, how much time? We're right about on the clock, so we're just about ready to wrap up, I believe. Want to thank you for being a guest and sharing us with us your business endeavor, but also all the insight you've given us about the state and national elections.
My pleasure. Always nice to talk with you guys.
Great.
Thank you very much, Beth. Appreciate it. And thank you, Josh. Everybody be safe and do the right thing, and we'll be back here in just a second. You're listening to Connections here on MSO, and this is MSONewsSports.com. Alrighty, that takes care of it. I told you it was going to be a full hour. I want to thank Robin Burns of the Salem Pantry, to Lindsay Haight, both executive directors. Lindsay Haight is the executive director up at our neighbor's table in Amesbury, Newburyport. Dave Radigan, of course, our resident What can we call him? He's an educator and a comedian, but he certainly lightens the load here. Always appreciate Bill talking with Dave. And, of course, to Beth Lindstrom, former senatorial candidate and an advisor at Genreo. And we've got connections. Yeah, well, we do have connections. We have links up to all of those sites right on our post right here on MSO and on our connections post. It is Genreo. I said Genreo. Genreo. We have those links right there on the post, and we'll be turning this into a podcast here very quickly. Don't forget, we do have connections coming up tomorrow. Many more interviews. Probably be posting around 10 o'clock. So on behalf of Josh Arnold, Bill Newell, and Bill Proposky, I'm Rick Moore. Be safe. Do the right thing.